Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts Rob Fanoff and Mark Zielinski as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
The Countercharge, I'm Jeremy Duvall.
I'm Greg Person.
And I'm Rob Fanoff. And as you just heard, we have another victim?
Elite guest, Rob.
A guest.
What did you sign me up for?
We call up guests, yes. But Greg has generously offered up a little bit of time to go inside the List Builder studio with us. And obviously one of the reasons why we're really excited to have Greg is he is I think he's a competitive player, but I also think he's probably more of a narrative hobby guy deep down in his heart. And so I think it'll be a good juxtaposition to where we have been recently and where we're going in the future. So it's kind of like a nice little diversion, if you will, to get someone with a different mindset when they're building a list. Greg, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fantastic. I appreciate you guys, obviously, for inviting me on. I've been joking with everybody, telling them that you contacted me because you've had too many good players, so you needed to balance the scales a little bit.
I don't think that's the case at all. I think, in fact, it's probably more of we just need some more hobby. Because obviously, if you think about it, a person that's coming at it from a hobby's perspective first versus somebody that's coming at it from a list or a competitive first, they come at the list from very different directions. And so we're excited to explore that with you.
Absolutely.
Well, Greg, why don't you start us off? I know everybody knows who you are. I mean, Painting Tabled was famous, right? Now you've got the Unplugged Radio. But give us a little bit of your background. Who are you? Who is Greg Person?
Sure, thanks. So I am a gamer, longtime gamer from Connecticut in the United States. So it's Northeast Coast. I started with Warhammer back 17 years ago now. And then when Warhammer went away, I jumped ship pretty readily into Kings of War, and I've been loving it. I do play in competitive tournaments, but for me, it's kind of like you said, the hobby that drives me. It's the social aspect. My club, the Unplugged Gamers, we also run a GT, which the previous 2 years has been Kings of War. Before that, it was Warhammer Fantasy. And we've had a lot of good success with going the Kings of War route. I've also been podcasting for a while now. I had the Painting Tabled back in the Warhammer days. And now, like you said, Unplugged Radio with Jake. And generally with John and Mike as well, who are, well, Jake's out of the Mid-Atlantic, but other East Coast guys. So,
are you ready to go inside the List Builder studio?
Absolutely. Let's do this.
The List Builder studio.
All right. So first question, we'll start at the top. You know, what draws you to an army? You know, is it the models? Is it how it plays? The rarity? You know, what draws you to an army?
For me, it's the models all the way. When I see something, it might be a particular unit, or it might be the whole range, or I just have a spark of an idea of, wow, using these models together would look really good on the table. That's where I start. And that's where I've always started. So I see something that I'm going to enjoy spending time painting, and then I figure out what a list would look like that includes those things.
I guess, when does it enter your mind, you know, whether or not this is going to be competitive, or does it never enter your mind?
It does. It kind of starts off with, I've got this idea for a hobby project because I want to paint these models, or I want to do this type of theme. And then I've kind of set the parameters. So if I'm going to use just these things, how can I build a list out of that that is going to be at least competitive enough where I have a shot at winning some games? So I might not even be looking at, you know, if I pick a force, I might not be using every single model in that range or every single unit entry in that range because I don't like the way certain things look or I don't have a good idea for what I would use for it. So I'm limiting myself competitively, you could say, in certain ways, but it provides a challenge that I like, where okay, if I'm restricting myself in this way, how can I build something that still is going to, like I said, have a shot at winning some games?
So when you're working on that sort of army design and you're coming from a little bit more of a model or a narrative bent, are you thinking about play styles? Are you thinking about themes, like either play style themes? Are you thinking about fluff themes? Is there kind of like a story that begins to sort of craft itself in your mind as you're beginning the list building process?
Definitely. At this point, like I said, I've been playing war games for 17 years. So I've done a decent number of armies, probably not as many as some listeners might expect over the course of 17 years. But as you'll hear me discuss, I'm slow when it comes to building and painting. But I try, with each new army I dive into, I try to pick something that's going to have a different play style than what I'm currently using. So whether that's trying to balance out a mix of combat, shooting, magic, or an army that's hits quick and fast, or an army that's a little slower but higher defense, that type of thing. So I'm looking at it that way. And then I'm looking at the models that I like, and I'm starting to think about why would these things be joining together in this particular combination to fight in battles.
Talk to me about inspiration. You kind of mentioned models, but you know, you get this. Where does that inspiration for a new project originate? Is it just purely you see a cool model, or is there other sources?
Well, I'll give you an example, I guess. So Dwarfs was the first army I ever played. I guess they're dwarves in Kings of War, but they had the F in Warhammer. Way back in the day, right when I started. And I moved away from them. I came back. I started a new army because why not? My painting skills had gotten better. And I was prepping to bring them to a tournament. And I was in the rare situation where I didn't actually have to paint anything in advance of the tournament. My army was ready to go. Which is a very rare situation for me. So I decided instead to focus on the display board. And so it was a dwarf army, and I had this mountain-type display board that you might imagine. And I decided, because I had a handful of goblins lying around from Battle for Skull Passbach, that I started a goblin army. It was like, you know, these are some iconic classic models. I've never had the chance to paint them.
Being like a hobby guy, I know a lot of people talk about when they play Kings of War, they're essentially kind of playing in their mind and their imagination. They're just playing Warhammer, but with a different rule set. Coming from a sort of narrative guy, are you trying to, in your mind, build in that fluff? Do you think Kings of War fluff moving forward is important to continue to grow so that the more narrative people have a bigger, more rich sandbox to play in? Imagination-wise?
Yeah, I am not one of those people. As soon as I got my hands on the book, I read through all of that fluff. I've done some things with my own gaming group to expand the fluff of Mantica with the narrative campaign that we ran last summer. And with the Edge of the Abyss book, I read the backstory for each of the living legends and all that stuff. So I really like the fluff that exists with Kings of War. I want to see it continue to grow, and obviously that's the direction they're headed.
I think that's great, and I think that's a good thing for us as a community to be doing, is to help make our own small contributions into building that fluff so that we're playing our games within Mantica, not in the old world, but with a new rule set.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so as far as, are there any foundation principles, or is there any things you like to do in pretty much every list you make, or is each list its own special snowflake? You know, it flows through the air by itself, or is there stuff that you like to see done in multiple lists?
Well, each list is definitely going to be unique in its own ways, but there are some things about my playing style that I found work well for me. So I like playing armies with lots of drops, and that does include having multiple units of chaff. And if I don't have those things, it's like I've been playing games for so long with that type of mentality, it becomes a little tricky to figure out, all right, how am I going to navigate these situations, these scenarios, and these armies that I'm facing. So I do tend to build lists that have lots of drops and when possible, include multiple chaff units.
Well, let's talk about chaff. Is there a set number of chaff units you like to include? And flip side, do you consider anti-chaff?
Well, yes to both. It depends on the list and what's available. So as I mentioned, I've played goblins in Kings of War, and I played undead pretty much those two armies exclusively. And with goblins, they have access to lots of fantastic chaff. The Mobius packs really stand out for me. They're not as fast as some other things, but they hit harder, so they prove to be pretty decent anti-chaff. And then the goblins also have access to a lot of mediocre shooting that isn't going to do much to the more elite units or high defense units across the table, but is fine for plinking couple points of damage onto enemy chaff units that maybe are faster than your own. So that would definitely come into play.
And you did mention number of drops. Just talk a little bit about how do you manage the number of drops when you're list building?
Well, it's one of those things you're trying to kind of have a core of your army that is valuable, and then another portion of your army that is throwaway. And it might not be throwaway without a purpose, right? So whenever I run characters that are, or heroes that are individuals, I want them to be mounted, because then they become fast enough that I can sacrifice them at appropriate times. So I might have a Wiz on a Fleabag who's Bane chanting or casting lightning bolts here and there, but at a certain point in the game, it's more important for him to step in front of that enemy unit that I've exhausted my other options. I just need to slow it down for a turn. Because he's on that flea bag, he's speed 10, so he can go 20 inches and get into position, and I'll be okay, right? So he's kind of fulfilling a dual purpose. But I might have another unit. I mean, goblins don't really have anything valuable, but maybe it's, you know, a horde of trolls and I've given them plus one to hit or something, so they're pretty expensive. So I'm using those other pieces that are expendable to protect them so they can get into combats and be fresh and be able to pump out the damage where I need them to pump out the damage.
So you've mentioned a little bit kind of purpose. You mentioned a little bit cores of your army or groups of your army. So when you're thinking about list building, you know, we've had lots of people come into the studio and talk about their philosophy about combat groups. Are you building things in smaller components that are supposed to work together? Are they interchangeable? Do you have combat groups that, you know, you always like to have those things work together? Or is it adaptable? Or speak a little bit to your philosophy about combat groups or smaller components of your army, or how do you kind of envision it all working together?
I don't think so much in terms of combat groups as I do sources of inspiring. So I like to have, I mean, both my undead and goblins have a lot of combat units. If I talk about, I guess, my undead for a moment, because I've been playing them a lot recently. The whole army is fast. I've got, you know, three or four sources of inspiring. So sometimes I need to concentrate some of my combat units together in one area. So maybe I only need one hero over there, or maybe I need two. Maybe I want to spread everything out, and so I'll dedicate, I might have, you know, four units that hit pretty hard. So I've got my four sources of inspiring, and I'll tag one along with each. But it's not like they're definitely married to a specific hero. And sometimes that, in fact, can work to my advantage. So I play in my undead, I have a horde of werewolves with the Brew of Strength, pretty solid unit, and I have a Lycanus, who is the werewolf hero. Well, oftentimes I will deploy my Lycanus early, and I like to have him go on a flank because he's speed 9, or I play him with a plus 1 move, so he's speed 10, and he's nimble, so he's kind of a flyer. He only operates slightly differently. And I'll put him down pretty early. And then I think, unless maybe I'm not outsmarting people, maybe it's just all in my mind, but I think my opponent then expects my werewolves to go near the Lycanus, because they're like, well, Lycanus is the werewolf hero. He inspires them, da 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 da. But then I'll throw the werewolves down somewhere completely differently. And, you know, just because the Lycanus isn't inspiring them, there might be a vampire who can do the same thing in a different area. So I like to keep it flexible where I have my sources of inspiring. They can clump together. They can spread out. And then if there's an area where I need two really good combat units, I can put two. If I want them all spaced out, I can have them all spaced out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's a kind of an interesting idea, is that when we've talked about combat groups in the past, usually it's like this unit and this unit, and then this character goes with them to back up. As opposed to if you have flexibility and you're inspiring individuals, knowing I have four inspiring individuals and I know that these units I want to be inspired, it gives you some flexibility that if you do need to deploy things on different sides, you know it's okay because there will be an inspiring unit placed there eventually to support that.
Right.
But on talking about inspiring, you know, there's different philosophies on, you know, I need everything inspired all the time, or I need a certain amount of inspiring per points. Kind of what is your philosophy as far as your goal into inspiring your army? Speak a little bit to how many inspiring choices you usually like to take. Do you think it's vital that everything is inspired at all times? Or speak a little bit to your thoughts on that.
That's a great question. I think it really depends, like I was saying before, about how much of your list do you view as valuable and you need to protect, and how much of it do you view as throwaway? Because even though some sources of inspiring can be pretty cheap, we'll go back to the goblins for a second, you know, a flagget is essentially another troop of Mawbeast pack. So if I'm going to say my list has 1,000 or even 1,300 points, that I don't care if I throw it away, instead of buying a few more inspiring sources, I'll just take more chaff units. But in a list that's a little bit more elite, like my undead, where I have some units like my Soul Reaver Cav, like, I'll be honest, if that unit goes down early, like, it's not looking too good for me, because I, you know, I need that unit to do work. So I definitely need to have enough inspiring and maybe even some people with heal to back that unit up to keep it around, right? But if I have a bunch of cheap units, I'm not going to spend additional points to give them a reroll on their nerve check, because my game plan isn't hinging on those units performing long term.
I think it's this idea that inspiring is meant to not force a second double ones roll, but instead protect you against that 10 or 11, right?
Right, right.
Well, let's jump in. You talked a little bit about goblins. Just in general, how has the new organized playbook that came out earlier this year affected your list building?
It hasn't necessarily affected what I'm taking so much, but I think it's influenced enough of my opponents where I see differences, and it makes it a little more enjoyable, because I was seeing in my area lots of, I've got the two flying, you know, hero monsters, and one's got regen and one's got defense 6 because of these items. And it was kind of like, all right, I'm going to fight that again. But I think people have become more creative, and it might just be also that people have more experience now playing Kings of War, but I've found a greater variety in the types of lists that I come up against. Although I got to say, after the last couple of tournaments, blood boil. I don't know.
Pretty tough.
It's pretty tough.
Yeah. What about like things like unit strength and the number of scoring units, which are new concepts from the organized playbook? How has that affected your list building?
I think that's been just a boon in general to the types of lists that I take already, because, like, as I mentioned, I like to have a lot of drops. And most of those are scoring units. And even if they're troops or regiments and it's not tons of hordes, when you have enough of them, it still gives you plenty of unit strength. It definitely has given me a little bit of pause, and I've seen it with my opponents as well, as you know, when you might want to include a horde, whereas in the past you would be maybe breaking that down into a couple smaller units just to get that unit strength 3 in there.
And you did allude to the organized playbook obviously changed some of, or retired some of, the magical artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about magical artifacts. How do you account for magical artifacts in your list building? You know, is it the first thing you buy, the last thing you buy? Do you just, you go light, you go heavy? just what are your thoughts on magical artifacts in your lists?
It's generally the last thing that I buy when I'm constructing my list. There are rare instances where I will have to maybe remove a unit that I wanted to include because I really need certain magical artifacts to go on certain units. But generally, if I'm playing 2,000 points, it's going to be maybe around 100 points of magical artifacts. There are certain units that are definitely, they need something on them to be a little bit more effective. And then there's other cases where different magic artifacts can make units more flexible or just enhance something that they're already doing. So I definitely include them. I've seen people who play with very minimal magical artifacts, and I think that's a pretty awesome way to go as well, because, again, it's just more bodies on the table. But I'm generally, like I said, thinking about my list in terms of part of it is expendable, so they're not getting anything. Part of it I need to rely on to accomplish things, and so magic artifacts are going to help them accomplish those things, so I need to take them.
In terms of looking at different types of lists or different types of armies, you know, elite versus the horde style, do you think that has any bearing on whether, you know, how many magical artifacts you take? You know, elite might have more magical artifacts versus horde may have less.
I mean, it could go either way, because certain units are effective enough on their own. They don't need anything else. Whereas if you have, I don't know, a ratkin army where you have lots of hordes of troops, and those troops are decent on their own, but you might want to start throwing some items on them to tip the scales a little bit. So I think they can find a good place in any list.
And give us your favorite magical artifact.
Oh man, my favorite magical artifact is definitely the Crystal Pendant of Retribution.
Do you have any good stories?
And I've never used it. I just think it's amazing.
Just your favorite. It's just your favorite.
It's just so good. Right? I have not personally witnessed any epicness with it, but I've heard stories from other gamers, and that always, you know, makes me feel good.
So being like a hobby guy, are you thinking about ways to maybe, I know some people, if they have a unit that always takes a certain magical artifact, they think of ways to, you know, model that in or multi-base that in. Have you experimented with that at all, doing stuff for modeling based on, you know, magical items or artifacts that your units have?
You know, I've never thought of that. That's a great idea. I haven't. And as we're going to talk about here, I am just now starting to work on an army that I'm building from the ground up for Kings of War. So I've been playing, like I said, with goblins and with undead, which are Warhammer armies that I've just converted over. I've added a few things to both of those armies for Kings of War, but I haven't really been in my mind like, all right, this project is fully for Kings of War, so how am I going to do these things? So now I'm looking at like what I'm going to be taking in the future, and you've given me some things to think about of how can I model in these artifacts.
Yeah, you know, I think that what you're saying is true, and I think in my local group, you know, Kings of War now has been out for a while. I think people are seeing its stability, seeing the growth in the tournament scene, you know, growth in the tournament scene in certain parts of the country. I'll give it. But they're seeing that this has some legs. So I'm seeing a lot of my groups from guys from my local group who are doing exactly what you're doing, which is I'm now going to build an army for Kings of War from the ground up. You know, right. I'm going to multi-base. I'm going to go for it. It's no longer am I repurposing an army from an old game into a new rules system. I'm going to build something specifically for this game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know what they say? They say, if it ain't flying, it's dying. Talk a little bit about how you feel about speed in your lists. Are you, how do you incorporate it? How do you build to fight it? Or, you know, speak a little bit about the importance of speed in your list building and kind of how you deal with that.
Well, obviously, like you said, speed is extremely important. I've, with the goblins, have access to a lot of shooting. I don't necessarily have all of those units. So both my goblins and undead are very combat heavy. And so speed is crucial, right, when it comes to pulling off charges that you need. So I like to take at least, you know, if you think about your army maybe having like a center line that doesn't need to be as fast, but then other elements that might support on the flanks where you want your high speed stuff, or with my undead, everything I have is high speed. It just projects a crazy amount of threats that opponents aren't necessarily expecting. So I like to include it as much as I can. If you've listened to Unplugged Radio, you've heard me go on about the Goblin King on Chariot, who, I mean, he's speed 9. He's a hero. And I don't mean just like the unit choice. I mean, he's a hero.
And he does amazing things.
Yeah. So, and then accounting for enemy speed can be simply having those throwaway units where, all right, in this situation, you know, going back maybe to my werewolves, well, my werewolves really want to charge you, but I'm facing Brotherhood and you've got a Horde of Forsaken, who I think that's the right unit name. They're the guys that fly. So you're faster than me, but if I put a unit in front of my werewolves, you can't charge my werewolves. And if you want to chew through that unit first, then I might get the charge on you, or you might decide you're going to go somewhere else. So having more units than your opponent, or having several things that can get in the way and block, is one way to basically neuter your opponent's speed.
Yeah, I think I like that idea. It's, you know, and we've talked about it in other facets of list building, where it's you either have the speed, or you have the X, Y, or Z, or you have methods to deal with X, Y, or Z.
Right.
So about allies, what about, are you allying anything in? And then also, too, I'm curious to hear your thoughts as kind of a thematic player. How do you think about allies? I mean, will you take allies if it doesn't make sense story-wise just to make your army better? Or the allies you take, do you have kind of stories in your mind kind of flowing about how this ally band showed up to help your main force? Or speak a little bit about how allies work into your sort of list building and hobby melting pot in your brain.
So I love allies. I'm a big advocate of taking allies. Part of that is my hobby aspect, where maybe I see one or two units from a different range or a different faction, and I really want to paint them up, but I'm not necessarily going to do a whole army. Well, I can paint them and include them, right? But I also think it's just more, it enhances my enjoyment of the game when the allies are there and it's tied in some thematic or fluffy way. I think all of the players out there who are running a combination of either Varanger with Abyssal allies or Abyssal with Varanger allies, like, I don't know, I can't get behind it. I saw the last term I went to, I saw a lot of Abyssal armies that were just like, and here's the Fallen, you know, because they're good. Even though it doesn't make any sense that they would be in my army. And, you know, no actual, like, I don't really have a problem with people who do that. It's just that's not the way I would play it. But it to me, I'm thinking about how it's going to go in. So my goblins have traditionally run orcs as allies because, like I said, it's a converted army. And back in Warhammer days, orcs and goblins were one force. So I still like playing that way. I also have some undead orcs and goblins stuff that I got from the Titanforge
company. Those are cool models.
People might be aware of. Yeah, so I've played a couple games where I ally in undead because I've got undead goblins and stuff, and it looks cool. They're terrible in game turns, but it looks awesome on the table. Yeah, so I'm thinking a combination of both.
And I think, like, what's Rob has spoken to in the past, which is so good about and interesting about the miniature wargaming hobby and Kings of War, is that you can approach these ideas from all sorts of different backgrounds mm-hmm. or philosophies, and it doesn't necessarily make one point of view as the right one and one is the wrong one. You know, we can all be entitled to our different ideas. Like, I would say I'm probably in between, which is I love fluff, but also I want to take something that's going to do good. So I think it's these different sides of the spectrum, right, where you're win at any cost, you're super fluff. But I think that we can exist in a continuum where we can be along that line and not necessarily have to be at either end of that bell curve.
Right. And I don't think, like, there's a right way of thinking about it, or that there's any reason that gamers who come to the table and you're in one area of the spectrum and your opponent's in another area, you're still going to have a great game, right? And that's kind of the beauty of Kings of War, where other game systems, if you have, you know, that type of thing where someone is more in it for the hobby and the fluff and they haven't brought the most competitive list, well, they might not have a chance really against the players who are going all out competitive. Where I think in Kings of War, if you're a good general, you always have a shot.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, list building matters to an extent, but I don't think it's a complete bar to success, meaning right. I don't think anyone auto loses in Kings of War, really. Right. I mean, maybe in an extreme circumstance, but, and I think also in the end, you have the power and agency to choose who you play with, right? So I think right. most people will build gaming communities with like-minded players. So if there's a certain type of player you don't like to play with, maybe you look for another personality type, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at a list, you're building your list. We've talked about all these sort of different gameplay elements, but one thing we haven't touched on yet is scenarios. So are you thinking about how your list is going to perform in different types of scenarios? Are you taking scenarios into consideration when you're building your lists? Speak a little bit about to that idea of building a list geared to tackle different scenario challenges.
So I think if you build a list that's well-rounded, then it's going to perform well in different scenarios. And if you get into a situation where you have a list that's maybe really hyper-focused on one aspect, you run into some trouble in some of the scenarios. So generally, I'm not actively thinking about different scenarios because I build lists that do a variety of things fairly well. But I'm thinking of some armies I've faced that are really slow-moving but really can put out a good ranged threat. But if you're playing a scenario where you've got to move that army to different parts of the table, you might not have the capacity to do that. And if your opponent is getting cover or they're obstructed by, you know, terrain that's height 4, those types of things, then you're really going to be in trouble. I think if you have a list like that, you're probably more actively thinking about, all right, what do I need to include to prepare for these scenarios? Whereas if you have a more balanced list, it's not really at the forefront of your mind.
Yeah, I think you bring up an interesting point. I think you speak to one of the, in my opinion, one of the great things I like about Kings of War is that I think it really rewards you for balanced list building.
Yep.
Because like you said, you've talked about if you have a movement-based scenario, right? If your list has different speeds, has some quick stuff, you're equipped to play a scenario that requires you to move around. If it's an objective-based scenario and you have some hammers or some anvils that can hold stuff, you're building towards a scenario kind of de facto by just building a balanced army.
Mm-hmm.
So what about deployment schemes? You know, we've had different players come in. I think one of the favorites that people have commented was Chris Kapsner will actually get his army and like do a mock deployment to see where everything will fit.
Yeah, I have something to say about that actually. So I was at Lady of the Lake, you know, back in July, and Chris very generously opened up his house to me and Jake, who flew in, and literally we slept in the basement. Now I woke up to get, you know, use the bathroom, get a glass of water at 4 a.m, and there's Chris in the basement. He's got his table set up. He's got his army. He's muttering to himself, moving things. You know, he's wearing his pajamas. I was like, Chris, what are you doing? He's like, not now, not now. I'm trying to practice. So yeah, the man really does it, and he's dedicated.
That's awesome. That is hilarious. Okay. How am I gonna get my herd in his face?
Yeah, I don't even know how you follow up to that. I mean, talk about intimidation. This guy goes all out. He's into it.
He wasn't even playing in the tournament. He was running it. It was a thing. Well, I will say, though, for my end on deployment, I play armies that are very aggressive traditionally. And so I don't really have a set deployment. And because I generally have more drops than my opponents, If I have the points for it, will include the Scrying Gem. And like I said, I've got a divide in my list between expendable and valuable. So I will unload all of my expendable stuff and wait to see where my valuable units basically have opportunities to go in really good positions. So that might mean facing off against certain opponents where I know I have a speed advantage, or I have, you know, the right thing to counter what they're bringing to the table. Or it might mean I'm loading up heavy on one flank, or I'm balancing across the board. I can't remember now which list builder studio I was listening to. It might have been Alex. I've listened to most of them. It might have been Chris, where we're talking about, you know, certain areas of the board you want to just devote enough units, enough points to tie things up. You know, you're not going to win the fight over there, but you're going to delay your opponent long enough where things are going to go well in other places, because there's a points difference. They've committed more points than you, but you're going to hold them up long enough where they're not going to be able to do anything else the rest of the game. And that's definitely always a huge factor to how I play basically any scenario where I'm looking at parts of the board where I'm planning on controlling this area, whether it's because there are objectives there or because there's terrain I need to control or there's specific units I need to kill as the scenario dictates. And then other areas where I'm just going to delay my opponent and hope that it holds out long enough where they can't come back and rejoin the more important areas of the battle.
And I think you bring up an interesting idea, and looking at all these, you know, we've covered all these different elements and how they're all intertwined, whereas you're describing the style of reactive deployment, but a key aspect of that reactive deployment is your number of drops. Because you can't reactively deploy to your opponent unless you outdrop them. Are you scrying gem or something like that?
I think another thing that's important, which could have been brought up basically at any point in this discussion with the questions you've asked, is I found you definitely want to have multiple Pathfinder units. As I'm working on Force of Nature, now that's not even an issue because everything has Pathfinder. One unit, which is kind of how I was playing for a while. It's a problem. Either you have multiple Pathfinder units or you have enough units where it doesn't matter. But the common trend from what I've seen of playing in my region and other parts of the country is that there's a lot of terrain on the board. And you don't want to be stuck with, like, well, he's got one Pathfinder unit, so we know he's going to put it in this area because there's the terrain piece he needs to get through. Because if you're playing that reactive deployment, you don't want your opponent to know where your valuable things are going to go until they go down.
That's an interesting point you just made, Greg. You know, and we've had some people that have come on and said, well, it depends on if it's obvious or not. So, like, if you have a unit that is obviously going to go in a certain spot, well, then why not just start with that? Because that's where they're going to expect it to go, and you might as well go ahead and put it there.
That could certainly be a way to do it. But like I said, I tend to go into the deployment phase thinking that it's going to be very important to dictating the outcome of the battle, because my army is aggressive, it's fast, it needs to go in the right place to get the right charges to win the game. And so, like I said, I don't want my opponents knowing where any of that stuff is going, basically.
Maybe it's more that you're playing underpowered armies, maybe?
Maybe it is. Maybe it's just I have a desperate scheme to maybe get a draw out of this game.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's jump in and talk about terrain and how that affects your list building. You touched on Pathfinder. You know, some wiser people than me have said, you either have to be fast enough to get around the terrain or have Pathfinder to go through it. So, you know, what about things like Strider? You know, how else is terrain specifically affecting your list building?
I do tend to think of it in terms of getting cover for different units. I like to have units of varying heights because then they'll interact with the terrain differently. So, for example, my Goblin King on Chariot is height 3 because he's large cavalry. and a lot of tournaments and stuff like that are using height two hills. So my king can be behind that hill. He can charge over it, but he's also going to get cover. So that's pretty sweet. Whereas my trolls, they're large infantry, so they're only height two. They're not going to be able to operate the same way in that situation. Of the various units I have, so that they can use terrain to their advantage, both when they're trying to hide or trying to see over it, but still get cover. And then another thing, again, because I guess I'm so focused on combats, playing aggressive lists, that if your unit hits hard enough, it's okay to be hindered. Strider is definitely a great rule. It's one of the things people might sometimes forget about the giant, and the giant's fantastic. So he, you know, he can't move at the double through that terrain, but he can charge right through and still whack you with his club.
Talk to me about how terrain affects your deployment. I mean, you kind of already touched on a little bit in terms of you're trying to make sure you have cover.
Yep.
Is there any other concessions you make about terrain?
Certain tables can have areas that become really isolated or hard to get to because of impassable or blocking terrain. So I try to use that to my advantage in certain ways. Sometimes it might be there's an area of the board where my opponent just doesn't want to commit any of their units because they'll kind of be stuck and they can't get back. So I might put some of my fastest things there, hold everything back a little and advance a little more slowly while I sweep the leg, you know, Karate Kid style, and come around there. Or I might just try and use that terrain to protect flanks. So if it's a blocking terrain, I know I can move this unit up aggressively to the side of that, and I don't have to worry about someone charging me in the flank because there's that piece of terrain right there that's going to protect them. So it depends on the board, and it depends on what I'm facing, because you just, like I said, I kind of think of a different plan with each game that I walk into based on my opponent's army, the scenario, and the terrain that's on the board.
Talk to me about your thoughts on going first, that dice roll. Does that affect your list building or your deployment?
It might. In terms of deployment, I might say, okay, my opponent has this unit with a ranged attack and the range is blank and their speed is blank. So if they get the first turn, I don't want them to shoot me. They deployed on the 12-inch line, so maybe I need to deploy only 8 inches up or something like that. But that's pretty rare. Usually just one way or the other, I'm going to be coming at you pretty aggressively. I think there's some games where it's a huge advantage to go first, and it can really depend on the scenario. So one where you're trying to pick up the tokens and take them off the board. Is that loot?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've found games where my opponent or me getting the first turn makes a huge difference in the outcome of that game because you're racing to the middle to pick up those loot tokens. But there's other scenarios where, you know, it's not as important because it's more about where things are at the end of the battle. So it can depend, but there are definitely some advantages to having that last turn in some of the scenarios. And there are others where you really need the first turn to capitalize on your strengths.
So put your hobby hero hat on and tell me how it affects list building. And specifically, I know you have this story where you have a sweet looking unit that you've put a lot of time into. You've unfortunately discovered that it's maybe not as effective as you would have hoped, but you're still going to use it because it's awesome.
Absolutely.
Give me some stories.
That's every unit, right? That's because it takes me a long time to paint things. So once I've painted it, it's going to be in there. So looking at my goblins with my orc allies, I don't have what I think people take most commonly with those lists. But I have certain things that, you know, I spent a long time painting. I have a horde of the axe, just the, you know, axe and shield dudes. And that might not be the best choice in the list, but I painted a whole heck of a lot of those orcs. They're the manic orcs, and I love the way they look. So they're going in every time, right? And I'll figure out a way to make them work. Or I spent a really long time painting. It's, well, it was a Forge World model, the Colossal Squig. It was gigantic, and I put like a platform on him, and I have a bunch of night goblins, and they're firing bows. So I used to play that as the Arachnorok Spider in Warhammer. And in Kings of War, and I can't just, that base is gigantic, so it can't really be a monster. So I incorporated that into a horde of goblin chariots. Now, I know Chris likes the horde of chariot units because he was talking about those, but I've not found them to be particularly good. Maybe I just haven't had the right strategies with them or the right other units in my list to complement them, but I'll take that a lot because, you know, that gigantic squig looks awesome, and it's, you know, it's a centerpiece for my army. It's something that when I'm at an event and there's people who I haven't met or haven't seen my army before, that's going to draw their eye in, and they're going to want to come over and see my stuff and talk about it. And so it looks great. So let's put it in and hope for the best.
Is there ever been a unit that you love, but just is not making it to the table now?
Yeah, it's in the undead. It's the skeletons. I really love the Games Workshop skeleton models. That was why I started with their vampire counts in Warhammer when they re-released those skeletons. I thought they were awesome. And I have 60 of them painted, and they're not good. They're not good. So I haven't been using them.
I mean, I guess you could use them as revenants, right? And just say they're revenants.
It makes me sad. I have other units that are clearly revenants.
Okay. So that's what I've done with my regular. I have some regular mantic skeletons, and I agree with you. I never use them as regular skeletons, but they have shields, so they're tough. So when I got to play them as, when I want to play revenants, I just use them as stand-ins for that.
Well, mine have spears, you know, so even worse. Like,
hey, man, phalanx is a great special rule.
Yeah, when your defense 4, it's bad. And you get 5 extra attacks, but you hit on 5s, you know.
Well, I think that kind of wraps up the general list building section. And what we're going to do now is we're going to transition to talking specifically about a list that you've brought, which is your Forces of Nature list.
So, in typical, I guess, hobby first, gamer second fashion, the disclaimer is I've never played with this list. I probably won't play with it for at least a year, probably longer, the way that my rate of painting is going. But this is a list for Forces of Nature that I've built. It's like I was saying before, it's my first Kings of War army that I'm designing from the ground up. And I've started painting some of the elements for it. And it was exactly like I said, a case where I looked at, all right, Forces of Nature, what are the different models that are available to me? What are the ones that I really like and I'm going to enjoy painting? All right, now I've got these. So how do I make a list that I think or hope or pray will function out of that collection of models?
Did you do any play testing at all?
No, goodness, no.
What's your backup plan if you find that, say, the salamanders just aren't good? Or is somebody secretly giving you the information on what to use?
Well, I've discussed list design ideas with Jake and Mike and John, but of course none of them have experience playing Forces of Nature themselves. So I wouldn't say they're really, you know, experts that are guiding my opinion. There isn't much of a backup plan. If, you know, if it doesn't perform that well, okay, I'm going to have a nice looking army and I'm going to bring it to tournaments. I'll slowly paint more things to add and maybe replace certain elements if I find they're not doing the best job. But if it's, you know, if it's something that I really think this is, you know, my standout unit, I'm going to keep using it.
Well, the one benefit you have by choosing Forces of Nature is there's overlap with other armies.
Exactly.
Salamanders can be in the Salamander army.
Right.
Well, let's go through this list unit by unit. And as you tackle each unit, you know, we typically ask people, you know, what are the specific roles? You know, are they do they have an interchangeable function with other parts of their army? But also we want you to talk about, how are you going to model it? What's the theme? How are you going to paint it? Give us a little bit of hobby on each of the units.
Okay, absolutely. So just some overarching things. When I set out to start a new army, I wanted it to be majority mantic models because I want to you know, for what it's worth, support the company that is producing the rules that I enjoy. And so I had narrowed down a couple different armies that I liked, Mantics ranges. And then the other stuff you'll see when I describe, it's basically just supplementing a few other things from the Reaper line, because they have a seemingly endless number of models to choose from. And one thing that I think will be different from at least other Forces of Nature armies that I've seen is I really wanted to have a consistent paint scheme across the units. It's like you said, it's a kind of an eclectic combination of different things with the naiads and the salamanders and all that. So I wanted them to look cohesive on the table. So, and just looking at the list here, the first thing I've got is a horde of the naiad ensnarers. And I did give them a magical artifact. I gave them the Dragon Shard Shield, which was one of the new additions in the Clash of Kings book. And so this unit, I've played against it multiple times. I think it's a fantastic unit. It doesn't do a lot of damage. I've seen people run it with the Hammer of Measured Force, which isn't terrible. I mean, the 25 attacks hitting on fours, so maybe 12, 13 hits, and then you're damaging everything on fours, so maybe you can count on six damage each turn, which is, I guess it's respectable, depending on what you're facing. But they really, their big thing is that they're ensnare, they have a high nerve, they have regen 4. So the idea with the Dragon Charge Shield there in my Theory Hammer is kind of that they're going to move into a key location that I want them to hold on the battlefield. They're going to take a charge. They're not going to rout, because if they did, then the rest of the plan would go to pieces. So let's say they don't rout, and then they regen a bunch of their points of damage. You don't countercharge because their attacks aren't that great anyway. Instead, you drop the Dragon Shard Shield. Maybe you cast heal on them a couple times because you're nature and you have lots of heal. And then when they charge you the second time, now your defense 5 instead of 3. You still have ensnare. If you were in terrain because you didn't countercharge, if your opponent isn't a Pathfinder or have Strider, they're going to be hindered a second time. So I think it is a way to increase their survivability, and that's really what they're doing, is just they're there to survive for a couple turns, hold things up. So that's the idea with that unit. Like all of the units that I have here, they're going to be put on a unit base, and it's not the scenario where I'm going to have like multiple unit bases. So it's not like I have two regiments and I just combine them like Power Rangers to make the horde. It's just going to be a horde tray because I think it'll look the nicest like that. And hopefully I don't decide halfway down the line that I'd rather have two regiments. I don't think I will, but that's the idea. And the units are all going to be basically, I've built one unit tray, not for this unit, for a different one. But the idea is that they are moving through a wooded area, and it's kind of like the ruins of a civilization that nature has reclaimed. So I have this terrain kit that GW makes. I think it's called The Ruins of Osgiliath for Lord of the Rings, which is a great set with all sorts of different pieces. So I have some elements of that. I have some stones, and then I have like forest debris and different tufts that go on there. And I have some ivy that I have like growing up around the building, the remnants of the buildings. So the whole army is kind of moving through this area. And so it'll be designed around that. I'm not going to have 40 naiads on the unit tray because the terrain element will take up a decent amount. But I'm expecting somewhere in the realm of 30 to 34 will fit, because those guys aren't that big. So you can get quite a few on the base, and I think it'll look nice. So then I've got two regiments of salamanders, and it's basically a similar thing. I don't have to lock in. I guess I should say this list isn't necessarily finalized in terms of some of the magic artifacts or some of the heroes, because those are the more flexible pieces. But the big units, I'm definitely painting them. So the Salamanders, I've started painting them. Two regiments. I like that they have defense 5, and for a regiment, their nerve is 14, 16. I think they look cool with the two-handed weapons, and crushing tank strength 2 isn't terrible, but I'm going to keep the shields because I think they don't have enough attacks to warrant dropping their defense to get a better crushing strength. They only have 12 attacks. So those guys are pretty flexible, decent at speed 5. They can take a punch. They can join a charge when needed to deal out some additional damage, and they're fairly cheap for what they do, and they add unit strength. Then I've got a horde of, and those are obviously going to be the Mantic Salamander models as well. I really like those. A horde of Earth Elementals. And so for these guys, I do have the Mantic Earth Elementals. And then to supplement, I got a Reaper. I don't know what it's called. Might be called a Golem, might be called an Earth Elemental. But it looks very similar to the Mantic ones. It's just a little bit bigger. So I think with the four of them on one base, that'll make sense. I think this is a case where I like the models, and they also happen to be really good in the game. With defense 6, you know, they're pretty solid. So then I've got a horde of Forest Shamblers. These are also going to be the Mantic models. I don't think Forest Shamblers are very good. I'll come off the bat and say that. But I bought the Force of Nature, like, Mega Army from Mantic. I do have all the models for this army already. And they come in it. I think they look pretty decent. So I'm going to use them. Right now, I'm planning on giving them the Brew of Sharpness because I think they need something to make them effective. I mean, 18 attacks is nice, and Vanguard is nice. But they hit on 4s, which is meh, and they're only crushing strength 1, which is also kind of meh. So I think with Brew of Sharpness, they're hitting on 3s. I've got Bane Chant in the army, so all of a sudden, 18 attacks that hit on 3s with crushing 2 is pretty decent, and you can do some Surge shenanigans with them because they are shambling. I do have Surge in the list as well. So you might be able to get a flank on something that would really, at that point, with the plus 1 to hit, really be good night, hopefully. Then I've got a regiment of the Centaur Brace Striders. I really like Mantic Centaur models. I have seen, when those models were released, I saw some negative press on Twitter and stuff, and I don't understand. I think they're great models. I think they're pretty nice. So I've got them, and I picked up some of the Reaper Centaurs to balance it out so I can have some variety because they just have the 5. I think right now I'm going to take the regiment of the Brace Riders, but I do like the idea of taking troops of the Bray Hunters, I think they're called, the ones with the bows, to have some shooting, and that those are also fairly decent in combat. But for right now, I've got the regiment of the Striders in the list, and I put the Helm of Ram on them. So they hit pretty hard. Melee 3 is awesome, and crushing 1, Thunderous 2 with Pathfinder, of course, their big kind of downfall is defense 4 and only 12 attacks. But I'm envisioning them kind of going on a flank and being in a place where my opponent has to think about how far they move up with different units, because if you expose a flank, all of a sudden that unit would be much more of a threat. Then I've got a pair of druids, and I'm using one of the Mantic druids that comes in the box set and one Reaper druid who I really like. That was one of the first models I painted up. So one of the druids has been upgraded to get Surge 7 and also has Shroud of the Saint because they come with heal 2, so then it becomes heal 4. And I'm kind of thinking that that druid is either going to be casting Surge or heal every turn. And so having an extra 2 dice to roll on heal is pretty nice. And then the other druid has Bane Chant and Banner of the Griffin. So that one, you know, Bane Chant and Heal are both spells that you can cast on units that are engaged in melee. And so you probably wouldn't you know, they're kind of competing. So I don't want to have Shroud of the Saint on there because Bane Chant is generally going to be the better option. And Druids are, I think, are awesome. They start at 65 points. They come with Inspiring. So Banner the Griffin on there will be nice when I can bump up the Nerve on basically wherever I need to put it. Then I've got a Tree Herder. Didn't take a magic artifact on that. It's pretty solid. I do like the new model that Mantic has put out. I haven't seen it in person, but I had already picked up when I designed the list a model from Reaper that I love, and it's really goofy. He looks kind of like an ent from Lord of the Rings, but he's got like, you know, a lot of foliage on top of his head, and he's got a big old nose, and he's kind of making like an angry look, and he's shaking his fist at you. This is two like tree arms are balled into fists. So I like that guy. Then a Winged Unicorn. And for that, I'm also using a Reaper model. Right now, this is kind of the area where once I start playtesting, I can change it around. But the Winged Unicorn can be really flexible and do a lot of things. Right now, I've upgraded him to Lightning 5 and taken Scarlet Maw's Fenulian Amulet, so he would have Lightning 7, which is pretty nasty. I've had good results with using Lightning Bolt in the Goblin Army. And so that's good, but there are certainly other things that he could take. I mean, he also comes with Heal 7, which is nice. I was toying with one setup for him, which I think is probably overcosted, but would be fun, where you take the Boots of Levitation, so you can move at the double and still cast spells. And what is it called? Soul Drain. I've never seen anyone use it. It's from the Clash of Kings. Yeah,
that's great. I use it all the time in my my undead list on my Mounted Revenant King. It's awesome spell.
Yeah, I like it. So the idea is wherever there's a fight happening, he can kind of zip over there. You know, he can pivot and fly 20 inches, and then he could cast his Soul Drain. So I might play it that way. I might do the Heavy Lightning. I might do something else entirely. I don't know, but I think the Winged Unicorn is pretty cool. And then the last thing rounding out the list right now is a Greater Elemental, which I made an Earth Elemental because I love the model that Mantic makes for that. So that's what I'm looking at right now. Now, you just spent, you know, 50 minutes, 45 minutes listening to me talk about how I love having lots of drops, lots of chaff. You might notice that those things are missing from this list. So like I said, I wanted to challenge myself with a slightly different play style. But I also, you know, this is going to be the basis of what I build and paint. And then I'm going to look at where I might add in allies. So I love that Forces of Nature has pieces of different armies. So I might really decide that I love the Trident Realms, and so I grab a couple more units from the Trident Realms and I bring those in as allies. Or maybe I love the Salamanders, so I do that. Or maybe I love, you know, I've got Forest Shamblers and a Tree Herder, and maybe I add in some elves to complement that. Or for the chaff stuff, honestly, I'm thinking about, well, centaurs are part of the herd, and the herd has access to awesome chaff, so maybe I add more centaurs and have like more of a herd centric army. So the idea is that it's going to take me, like I said, at least a year, probably more than that, to paint this up. And I'm not going to really want to do a whole new army for the foreseeable future after that. But because it's got little pieces of other armies, I could add in, like I said, some stuff from Trident Realms or Salamanders or whatever, to keep my hobby juices occupied, and also to add some more flexibility and hopefully some tactical options to the list.
I'm right there with you. Yeah, it's a great way to build an army, is just to build like a core.
Yep.
And then you can just slowly add either other units or allies and just kind of, you know, play with what you know is going to work. And then
right.
add to it. How long has this list been in your head? You know, to talk about the development process, is it like changed wildly over time? Is it, you think it's going to change in the near future?
Well, I don't think it's going to change in the near future because, like I said, it was probably around February, coming back from Masters. I had a phenomenal time at Masters, and I'd been enjoying Kings of War, but it really, that experience solidified that, like, you know, this is definitely the game for me, and I'm going to go all in, and I want to make an army that is for this game. I want to make an army that's mostly the Mantic models. And so I planned out that these are the models that I like. This is basically what I want to do. I purchased all of the basing materials. I purchased all of the models. I purchased the paints that I would need, you know, everything. It's there. It's all sitting there ready to go. And three models have paint on them. Hooray. So it's locked in. I'm going to paint this, you know, maybe by the time I finish it, there'll be, you know, more changes to the rules. There might be a new organized playbook. There might be new formations, or who knows what the future holds. But, you know, until this core list gets painted, that's what I'm doing. And then I'll see from there how I might want to change it and add some different things.
I was going to say, Greg, you just mentioned basing materials. You just mentioned paint. Do you have, or is part of the hobby process for you, like, do you have an idea of how the army is going to be painted, how all the units are going to be based? Do you have that set in stone in your head? Or as you begin to paint and artistically build the army, is that something that may, along with your list, is that going to maybe change? Or do you feel you have a pretty dialed in thematic look of how you want the army to visually be by the time you finish?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I have gone through and I painted one of the ensnares. I've painted two salamanders. Oh, I lied. I've painted four things. And I painted a druid. And that was just to kind of test out the colors and how they would look on each of those units. I mean, to be fair, I do have kind of, I don't know, I might go through and paint one model from each unit and then just stick it on its unit base so that local games with my friends, you know, I can start playing the list. But I wouldn't obviously bring that to an event until it's legal with the minimum model count on there. But I picked the color scheme. You know, I painted the test models. I like what came out of that process. And then I built the unit base for one of the regiments of salamanders so that I would know exactly what I'm doing moving forward. Because I've kind of found that since I painted my orcs and goblins for Warhammer, which, I mean, I finished that army in 2014, so it's been a while. But since then, I've just kind of bounced back and forth, and I've painted a little bit for one thing and lost steam, and a little bit for another thing and lost steam. And I really wanted something that I was just going to lock in, and this is how I'm going to spend all of my hobby time. I'm not going to get distracted by painting other things or building other things. And like I said, coming back from Masters solidified in my mind that Kings of War was where I was going to devote that time. And so this is it.
You know, I think people talk about test models. Mm-hmm. I think we all do it. All, you know, all painters do it. But I think the idea you just brought up, I don't think I've ever heard. Usually you think test model, paint the unit, test model, paint the unit. But I could see the real benefit in painting a test model of one model from each of the units you want to have in your army. Because mm-hmm. again, that's giving you kind of like a little bit of visual taste of how the project may look completely together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an interesting idea.
I think it also just, at least for me, keeps it from growing stale, because the idea of sitting there and painting whatever it ends up being, let's say it's 32 Naiad and Snares, just sitting there and painting 32 of those things, like, that hurts my brain. Because I'm a slow painter, and, you know, with other armies I've done the batch painting process, where it used to be I'd paint, you know, 10 infantry models at a time. So I'd paint all of the weapons, I want all of the skin at one time. And then that, you know, when I did other armies, that kind of got narrowed down to, well, I'd do five at a time. But at this point, I paint one model at a time. I just from start to finish, and that's what I do. And I just find it more enjoyable. But the idea of repeating that process, because it is time consuming. I mean, the models I mentioned, the Naiad, the Salamanders, the Druid, it was probably an average of like 6 hours per model. So just think about how that time adds up when how many now, models are in this
airbrush,
list.
Do you airbrush at all or just brush paint?
No, just brush paint. Yeah.
Okay. No, same thing. I fear change. So it's like, I know an airbrush, you know, I know an airbrush is probably good, but it's like, I can't bring myself to like learn how to use it.
Right. I'm kind of set in my ways at this point. So
when you're thinking about a color scheme, is that something that just kind of comes from your brain? Do you see a piece of art, or when you speak maybe a little bit, do you have like a color scheme set for this army? Like, okay, these are my three basic colors, or how has the color scheme incorporated itself into your building this hobby idea?
That's a good question. Sometimes it's a result of seeing something that someone else has painted, or like the studio paint job or whatever of the models, and you really like it and you want to emulate it. Other times it's just, it might be the complete opposite. You know, I think I have a way of painting these models that's different than what I've seen before, and I think it'll look good, so I want to do it that way so it stands out a little bit. Or it could be something where it's tied, you know, directly to the fluff, where you want to paint, you know, a dwarf regiment a certain way, because in the stories, that's the way this regiment, you know, it described them being that way. But I have... I have found that in pretty much all my armies, purple is included in the color scheme in one way or another. It's just, it's my favorite color. I like to paint it. And I didn't really think it was going to be part of the Force of Nature. And then I painted some models and there it was. So it's kind of, I think of having like three main colors that pop up in different combinations depending on the units or the models. So the three main colors in this army are purple, green, and beige. And I like the beige because it's more neutral and it kind of balances out the green and the purple, which pop a little bit more. But then on different models, there's different combinations of it. So the Salamanders might... You know, the Salamanders I painted, they have like beige kind of scaly skin, and then they have this like armor plating stuff that's purple, and then their shields are green. But the Naiad I painted has, you know, green is featured a lot more strongly. So it helps to distinguish the units from one another, but they're still all tied together with the same theme. And obviously there's other colors going on. It's not just those, but those are the predominant ones that are gonna appear on every model. You know, the Salamanders, some of their weapons might be metal, some of them are made of bone. You know, other models might not have any metal on them, that's okay. Other models might not have any of the bone color, something like that. But those three colors are gonna be there, which are gonna unify the army.
When you're doing this army, do you do like a design dossier, like layout the rules for painting this army? Like, I'm going to paint this thing on any model this color, or you just, it's organic. You have a set palette and you allow it to flow wherever it goes naturally.
Yeah, it's been a little more organic. I know what the basic colors are that I want to use, but I don't know exactly where it'll go until I've built the model and painted it. And honestly, with some of this, the models for this army, you know, it's not, I haven't seen examples of some of these models painted in person, and the pictures available online, there aren't a ton. So there are times where I'm looking at a model, I'm like, what the heck is that piece right there? I don't know what that is. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to paint it because I'm not sure what it's supposed to be, you know, because it's not as like, I guess it's not as commonplace that you see these models around. as some of the GW stuff was. So it's a little more organic, but I do have like, you know, I have a journal where I have like all of my recipes written down. So, you know, the way I paint the bone on salamander is going to be the same way I paint the bone on, you know, the forest shambler or whoever. So this is the process. So it'll look consistent.
All right. Here's a random question. You obviously live with a pretty good painter.
Yeah.
What's the best tip Peyton ever gave you?
The best tip Peyton ever gave me.
And for those who don't know, we're talking about Peyton Shipman, who is a very accomplished painter in his own right.
Don't paint freehand when you're drinking. Because, well, we won't go into the stories behind that, but that is a good, but honestly, Peyton is just a machine. He paints so frequently. He just, most days he comes home from work, he sits down and he just powers through. He's working on a Kings of War army right now. I don't know why he doesn't post this stuff up on social media. I'm going to have to like commandeer some of his models when he's not looking and take pictures, but he's doing a League of Rordia army. Now talk about, it's the same process I'm doing where he likes the models. They're from Westphalia Miniatures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the list he's building, I mean, it's not going to be good, but it's going to look awesome. And yeah. So it's coming out really nicely right now, but people haven't really seen it because he's just been painting it in the house, you know, with me. So I might post some of those pictures.
Yeah, I think you posted one. It's like a teal. I think I saw some halflings that were some bowmen. I think they were teal colored tunics.
Yep.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. You know, talk to me about color choice, because, you know, I'm a big believer that you can even be just an okay painter, but if you have the right color choice and composition, it goes a long way.
I agree with you 100%. I think that the color combinations on your models and then the way the base complements your models is more important to a certain extent than your technical painting ability. Whereas if you can apply colors in a good pattern that are pleasing to the eye, but you're not the best painter, like that's still going to look awesome across the table. And I also think it can work against you, where I've seen people who are excellent painters, but it's a garish paint scheme that just, no, it doesn't really work and it really detracts. So it's not like there's a specific rule, like, you know, if you use orange, you can't use yellow on the model. But if you look at a color wheel and you look at color theory, there are certain combinations that work well. And there's also like a limit where you don't want to feature, you know, 17 different colors on one model, even if each color is painted really amazingly. That's going to look like nonsense because your brain can't focus when you're looking at it. So you generally, one thing you want to do if you have, so I said these are the three like main colors I'm using, but they're different combinations. And so generally two of those colors will feature predominantly, and then one will be the spot color, which is less prominent, but is placed strategically to break things up. And you generally want it to be placed in some sort of triangular fashion. So if you picture an example of like, I don't know, like a human wizard who's got like a cloak on. So maybe there's like two colors on their cloak, or it's their beard and their hair and the cloak. Those are like the main colors. But then the flesh on the hands and the face, which are exposed, that's the spot color. And if you paint that well and it complements the other colors you have, it'll look really nice.
I think you bring up some really interesting ideas, like that idea, like what Rob was saying, which is good sound color theory choice with basic techniques can mm-hmm. often look better. And especially when you put in the 3-foot rule from, mm-hmm. you know, could look so much better than someone who's got excellent technique, but they're just have 15 colors on one model.
Yeah, I think most people, if they have, you know, steady enough hands and patience, can paint their models cleanly where, you know, you're not getting like color where it's not supposed to be. And you just put, you know, your one base coat and then you apply your wash. And if you've got nice colors and you've done it well, then that's going to look nice. And if you go back and you add more highlights or layers, that's great too, but just that basic start is going to look good. And really the base for some armies throws things off for me, because it might be really nice, but it's just colors that kind of clash or compete with the models. Like, I don't want the base to take away from the model that I'm looking at. And I don't know, I thought, like, back in Warhammer days, like, maybe, like, it's a really cool concept because, you know, Khorne is the skull god and you're sacrificing skulls, but if you have, you know, 50 skulls on your base and that's all that's there, it looks really weird with the model on top, you know what I mean? Or sometimes people do the lava basing. I've seen examples of that where it looks good. I've also seen examples of that where it really detracts from the models themselves.
He's like, what you're talking about is true, which is a model and its base is a composition, right? You're a painter. I mean, we're all painters, you know. It's creating in our own way pieces of art. And I think if you can begin to look at the model as its whole composition, which is the model itself, the base that it's on, the other units in the unit that go with it. And you know, and especially with Kings of Rule multi-basing, you're kind of creating one composition.
Yep. So that's another element then with the multi-basing, which is having some varying height in your unit can look really nice. It can also look really bad if it's way too extreme. But just like, you know, areas where models are placed a little bit higher than others because maybe you've textured like a little incline, or there's rocks that, you know, they're standing on or whatever, that can also make it look a lot more interesting than just, you know, 20 guys all on the same level, all in the same pose, that type of thing.
Let's talk about the tools of the trade. Let's start with a simple question. What's the most important tool for painting?
The most important tool for painting, I think, is a wet palette. Or failing that, using some type of, you know, acrylic medium so that your paints don't dry out immediately.
Now, what about paints? What do you have a favorite paint brand?
Well, I think Peyton and my friend Jeff would kill me if I didn't say Scorpion Green was my favorite color. But I've been using the Citadel paints since when I started, so that is the majority of what I use, although I do have some different, like I use P3's Moro White, I find is my favorite for just like a pure white color, and I have some Reaper paints that I use here and there, but generally it's the Citadel range that I pull most of my colors from.
Dropper tips or paint pots, do you have a preference? I know you say you mainly use the Citadel stuff, but if you had your druthers, what would be your preference?
So I know there's a lot of fans out there of the dropper bottles, and I understand that they have their advantages, but I have a story for you, which has turned me off of the dropper bottles. So back in the days of when I was recording Painting Table, I was painting, and there were several of us sitting around the table in my house, and I was working on my Terrorgeist for my Vampire Counts, which, if you're not familiar, it's like this large undead bat type thing. It's gigantic. I'd spent more time painting this model than anything ever up at this point. And I'm perched on top of a building. Like, it's crazy. And I was pretty close to finished. So I sunk a lot of hours. And I had a Reaper bronze color. And I hadn't used it yet. And so I took it and I flipped it upside down and I applied a small to moderate amount of pressure, let's say, and it exploded and bronze paint got everywhere. It got all over my Terrorgeist, and, you know, it's bronze. So it's like it was very obvious that it was all over that. It got all over the table. It got all over John's hat. John will still complain to you. Let's say if we bring this story up, to him, the real crime isn't that, you know, 40 hours of my painting were just like compromised. It was that bronze got onto his beanie. It's a sore subject for him. But it was, yeah, it was terrible. So I'm leery of using bottle caps for that, or the dropper bottles for that purpose.
So talk to me about, are you a layer guy or are you a blend guy?
I am generally a layer guy. I've done blending. I think it looks nice, but I think when you're painting an army, layering is more practical. I don't like do extreme jumps in color. So I know a lot of people, well, maybe not a lot, but I know that some people do. So they might have however many layers, it might be just three layers, but it's like a, you know, it's a brown to a tan to like a bleach bone, like boom, 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 like real stark contrast, high jumps in layers. And that can look awesome from across the table. But then when you look at it close up, it doesn't look as good because it doesn't make sense. So I am generally doing more layers that are smaller gradations, like smaller jumps in color changes. And I also like having very dark recesses, not to the point where I'm black lining, which is something I did with my Orcs and Goblins, where like all of the recesses were like a solid stark black line, which makes it really pop and it makes it look very cartoony. Not going that route with the Forces of Nature, but it's still dark. So there's a lot of contrast, but it's not necessarily going as bright as other people do. And so I find that generally my army won't stand out as much across the table as some others do, but it holds up a little better when you look at it more closely.
Do you glaze? Do you work with glazes at all?
I do. It depends on the color. But definitely like lighter colors, I like using glazes. Because when you're trying to highlight something like an orange or a yellow, the color can kind of get washed out because you're going closer towards white. And a glaze can be nice to bring back some of that richness of the color tone. It can also be a nice effect when I painted my ghouls for my undead. I use different glazes to get different like bruising type effects on their skin. So it's not something that I'm using all the time, but in certain areas it can be really effective.
So let's go back and talk about this purple that you use.
Yeah.
Now you said it's your favorite color. You know, some people over the years, Johnny Hastings would probably say blue is his favorite color.
Right.
Because he's mastered it, right? Is that why you like purple so much? Is that you've mastered the technique and you've nailed it? Or is it you feel, you know, that you're royalty?
I think it's because I feel like I'm royalty. Actually, I have an interesting story about this. So I don't know that I've nailed it. I think my purple looks good. And if you've seen some of the pictures of my Force of Nature stuff, you'll see it and you can judge for yourself. But there was a... I'm not sure they do it anymore, but there was a local hobby store in Connecticut that ran a yearly painting competition. And they would have it where there were different categories and you bring in, you know, single model fantasy, single model sci-fi, you know, unit sci-fi fantasy, whatever. You get the idea. And one year I decided to bring all and historically I've done well at this painting competition. And one year I decided I was going to bring all stuff that had squigs because the squigs were purple and I liked the way they look and I thought it would be cool. And so everything I had, you know, the hero was like the goblin on the great cave squig and the monster was the colossal squig that I was telling you about and the infantry were the squig hoppers, right? And I submitted them and I was like, this is going to be awesome. And then my feedback from the judges, I didn't do that well and I didn't do as well as I had in the past. And the feedback from the judges was that they didn't like the purple. So here I was like, yeah, I love this color. I'm going to submit everything with purple. And they were like, nah, no good. But since then, I've gone brighter with the highlights, which I think it probably would have helped me in that competition.
You mentioned it before that you are an army painter. You know, you're not necessarily painting Golden Demon. You're painting armies.
Right.
So what's the number one tip for an army painter?
Ooh, set limits. There are certain. So one thing I do, which I really I think it's great. I just think it's great. And you mentioned Johnny Hastings, who's a phenomenal painter. And he does not do this, at least from the armies I've seen. So when I look at, like, Johnny's Beastmen, that's what I've seen in person. They look beautiful. And every detail on that model, every part of that model has been given the same level of love and attention. So the skin, the horns, the weapons, and even the little like pouch on the belt of his Ungor, is painted to the nth degree. But when I'm painting my models, because I know that I'm already sinking a lot of time into them, and I know that I'm painting armies, there are certain parts of the model that I don't spend as much time on, and I don't paint as many layers because it's not the focal point. So it saves time, but it also helps draw the viewer's eye to the parts of the model that you want them to pay attention to. So if you look at my salamander, for example, he's got these like leather straps that kind of go across his body, holding, and there's metal, I don't know, whatever. Maybe he's in it, so some S&M stuff, I don't know. But I've painted those like a dark brown, and it's the base coat, it's the wash, and it's one layer of highlight. Whereas the purple, the green, the beige, the bone, other areas, I've given, five or six layers to. But that is minimal because I think I don't want it to stand out. I don't want to put five layers on the leather strap and draw your eye to the leather strap because it's just, it wouldn't look like that either if you were to like look at somebody wearing that type of outfit. I don't know. So I find that you pick certain parts of the model that you can spend less attention to, which will save you time, but will also help draw the viewer's eye to the things that you spend more time on because it's not as confusing to look at.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. In fact, it reminds me of something Chris Walsh said on our previous episode where he paints them to a certain, the models individually to a certain level, and then he mounts them on a base, and then he goes in and does the final detail work because theoretically, there's going to be things that are not going to be visible once you unit base this thing. And so why spend any time on something that the viewer cannot see?
That's a great point, yeah.
Are you ready? We've got 10 questions for you.
Sure.
As we say to all of our guests, they're really designed for rapid succession. We'll say the question, just whatever pops in your head, that's probably the answer you were meant to say.
Okay.
Are you ready, sir?
Yeah, bring it on.
What's your favorite army?
Goblins.
What's your least favorite scenario?
Kill.
What drives you creatively or competitively?
Creatively.
When you roll snake eyes?
I cheer.
When your opponent rolls snake eyes?
I cheer.
What is your favorite hobby material?
It goes by different names, but Vallejo makes it. There's different colors. It's like this sand paste mixture. So you just kind of paint it right on to your bases, and then it's basically like using gravel, but it's a finer grit, which I think looks more realistic, and you can also build it up into different layers. So the one that's black is called black lava, or there's like there's all different ones, but you can look it up. It's awesome.
What is your favorite gaming pet peeve?
When people aren't paying attention to the game, they're like playing on their phone or things like that.
If you had to replace miniature wargaming with another hobby, what would it be?
Oh God. I guess just two-dimensional art. So painting and drawing.
What other miniature war game would you not want to play?
Would I not want to play? War Machine.
If you had a romantic evening with Ronnie Renton, what would you whisper sweetly to him?
I would whisper, I love you, but hire an editor.
Greg, that's fantastic.
Awesome. So true and poignant. I was moved.
Timely. Well, Greg, hey, I know we've taken up your whole evening, but we just really wanted to say thanks for coming on and spending a few hours with us.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. This was a lot of fun. And like I said, hopefully people find some enjoyment. But even if they don't, I had a good time. And so that's what matters.
Final thoughts?
Just get in touch. If you want to talk about some of the things I said, if you have some differences of opinion or some similarities, I'd like to hear it. And it's an ongoing discussion. And if you have some suggestions for different ways I could use those models that I'm planning on using, by all means.
I think that's going to do us tonight. Until next time, keep countercharging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by posting on our episode thread on the discussion forum found on manticgames.com. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.